This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of The Overcomers, God's Vision for You to Thrive in an Age of Anxiety and Outrage, written and narrated by pastor and best-selling author Matt Chandler, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pastor Mike, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by the Reformed African American Network. I am your host for this podcast, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter at Burns23. As always, we have our president and the co-founder of the Reformed African American Network with us, Jamar Tisby. Jamar, what is going on today?
It is another episode of Pass the Mic, but it's not just another episode. We have an incredibly special guest with us, Colin Hansen from the Gospel Coalition. Welcome, Colin.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
This is long overdue, brother. My goodness, I think since first of all, I've been a longtime reader for many, many, many years and have learned a ton from you guys and from all the writers that you have there. But you all have played a pivotal role in the history of RAN, and I'm not sure all of our listeners know this, but you all gave us a shot. You took a shot. You took a gamble on us when we weren't known, and I submitted some posts to you all, and you put those up, and you have invited us to your national conferences and given us space there and opportunities to present. So we are indebted, and I just want to formally thank you and the Gospel Coalition for all your support of the Reformed African American Network and Pass the Mic.
Well, Jamar, that means a lot to me. I'll never forget. It was 2013, right? Our first national conference in Orlando, and we gave you guys this little workshop room and thought, well, let's see what happens, and put it really early in the morning.
Super.
And then all of a sudden, just everybody just descends on this little room, and everybody's sitting in the aisles, and I don't even have a space inside the room, so I'm having to look at you from out in the hallway and just seeing you in your element, Jamar. And that was just an exciting moment for me, and it's been simply a pleasure to see how the Lord has grown RAN and you personally over the years. So this really is a special moment for me to be talking with you guys.
Well,
yes.
Go ahead.
And I actually just wanted to say I was there in that room in 2013. Awesome. And if not for that, I don't think I'd be with RAN today. So that was the time where I actually, it was my second conversation with Jamar. I had a previous conversation with him at another conference, but it was a time where they really roped me in and said, you need to write for us. And then the rest is history.
Amen.
Yes. So it all started there. Appreciate you all. So tell us about your role at TGC. What's your title and kind of what are your day-to-day responsibilities?
My job is editorial director. I've been in that position since July of 2010. I kind of just made up the title. So that tells you a little bit about how I came on board at TGC, a pretty small organization, just sort of fledgling at the time with our editorial efforts. We had a couple bloggers, well-known, Justin Taylor and Kevin DeYoung in particular at the time, and came in to just try to expand that editorial reach. And then since then, we've kind of grown the number of editors that we have involved and the amount of material that we publish. So I also oversee our book publishing and our curriculum, also the programming for our conferences, and just various other things that relate to TGC's mission of trying to reform our ministry practices to conform to Scripture. That's the overall purpose that we serve. And it's trying to keep that gospel center at the center, that story, that message of Jesus Christ, that he comes to save sinners and intercedes now on our behalf. We're trying to keep that central. And so it's kind of my job to navigate those waters to make sure the content continues to reflect that message. But then it's my job also then to oversee how that message gets out and how we apply that in various different ways with the hundreds of writers that we have involved and our different bloggers and things like that. So we end up getting into a lot of different issues, a lot of controversial issues. And one of the things I've noticed is that if you're seeking to be controversial, just keep focused on Jesus. Because he was controversial.
Yep.
And he offended different people at different times. So we don't judge our faithfulness depending on how we offend people. But no, at the same time, neither do we think that if we're offending people that somehow we've betrayed Jesus. In fact, he promised that is exactly what would happen if we're following him. And so as it relates to any issues, political or racial or economic or sexual, you stay focused on Jesus, that's going to be controversial. So in my job, that's part of what I do in overseeing our editorial staff and working with our writers is to try to keep us all focused on that message.
That sounds like the lesson you've learned in the School of Hard Knocks.
I'd like to think, Jamar, that I learned it early on, but I remember vividly there was a moment I was speaking at our 2015 national conference with a group of our writers, and one of our best writers asked me a question, and it was, how do you respond to the criticism that the Gospel Coalition is so political? And I said, that's an interesting critique, because I only hear it when we talk about certain issues, namely those political issues that the person raising the issue, raising the problem, doesn't like. And so I've never run into anybody who's complained for me being political as it relates to abortion or same-sex marriage or things like that. It's when I talk about other stuff like money or race or things like that, all of a sudden I get criticized for being political, or the Gospel Coalition in general gets criticized for that. And so a lot of that, you're right, Jamar, it has been learned in the School of Hard Knocks to recognize that you're not going to keep everybody happy, but you've got to, if you can't stay grounded in Jesus, you're going to get blown by the winds, and that can, you never know where that's going to end up, and you're just not going to be able to survive that criticism personally. So that's a little bit of what I'm going through just right now. And I don't claim to actually do it well all of the time, because I'm a sinner who needs grace and is growing in my own sanctification by the Spirit, hopefully. But it's just one of those things that without this vantage point at TGC, I might not have been able to see in precisely the same way.
Now, you wrote an article actually coming up in September of this year. It's going to be, as we're talking offline, a 10-year anniversary of an article that you wrote with a term that has become pretty much common in our lexicon in American Christianity, and that's young, restless, and reformed. So 10 years ago, you wrote this article. Hard to believe now. It's been a decade, and so many of us have been influenced by this term and the thoughts that you have given surrounding the term. So what has the transition been, and how has it been different since the day you wrote that article to 2016?
Oh man, so many different things One of them I just wanted to say first off is that when I wrote that article, a lot of people, especially older people, thought that I was crazy and that I was making it up. So I specifically got feedback right. from institutional leaders within the evangelical world saying, this isn't a real thing. This is a fixation of your imagination. So I'll never forget the parking lot outside of the condo where I lived in Illinois at the time, talking with my wife, and I looked at her and I said, is it true? Am I making it all up? Is this maybe even wishful thinking on my part? And for journalists, those are real questions that you have to always ask yourself. Well, nobody's asking that question anymore. It's certainly a real thing, and if anything, continues to grow 10 years later. At the same time, there have been a lot of growth pains. And one of the biggest differences is that I remember looking and seeing some of these movements, especially a lot of the dynamic movements of church planting in urban areas. And I remember thinking, this is either going to be one of the most amazing revivals that God has ever sent us in the United States of America, or it's going to be a complete disaster. And I guess it's probably been both. Which I guess is kind of how things always work.
Yep.
I mean, the Lord is doing amazing things that we wouldn't have thought possible 10 years ago, especially in urban cultures. And also some of it's been a disaster. So that's just kind of, that's just part of what I've learned to deal with and try to describe. So if I thought about going back and writing the article again, I really couldn't do it. It's a totally different situation now. There's no surprise factor, but there's also very much a heavy, like, wait a minute, what happened to all these different people that you wrote about 10 years ago? What happened? Where did they go? Well, I mean, there have been a lot of ministry failures. There have been just a lot of people who, some people were reformed because it was a fad, and they were reformed because it was their way of getting back at the church that they didn't like growing up. Well, and they grew out of that, and now they don't like Reformed people. So there's a lot of those factors, and definitely one of the biggest changes is there. One, this Young Ushers Reform movement is significantly more ethnically diverse, maybe in reality, but certainly also in perception. I did hint at Reformed hip hop in my original article. I wasn't aware of it then, but in my original book in 2008. But that dynamic has become a much bigger factor. But as that diversity has come along, then also you've seen a lot more tension, because it's exposed a lot of the, I think, idols in our culture, including in our church culture, including among Reformed Christians. So those are a lot of things that 10 years ago, Tyler, I could not really have anticipated when I wrote that article, and would have been way beyond the scope of my 6,000-word investigation for Christianity Today.
So go ahead, Jamar.
I'm just curious how you parse, I mean, the term young, restless, and reformed. I think the young is pretty straightforward. The reformed, for folks who are listening, probably understandable. What's the restless part? And is that still, you know, is that still the word you would use to describe it today?
Yeah, the restless part, I think that was really the key, because it wasn't really clear how this was going to play out. It wasn't really, I mean, a lot of these folks were Baptists calling themselves Reformed. Like, how is that going to work out when Reformed is often referred specifically to Presbyterian denominations, at least in people's minds? Mm-hmm. How would, when these people grow up, would this movement not merely be a reaction to something? A lot of people have, I think, accurately described the movement as in part a reaction against two different things. One, a lot of the megachurch models of ministry that especially white Reformed evangelicals grew up with. And second, against emergent style liberalism resuscitated from earlier movements. So again, coming out of some evangelical worlds, but predominantly white. And so it wasn't quite clear at the time, is this just a reactionary movement? And in some ways, it has been a reactionary movement. And in some ways, it's also actually settled down. So it's a little less restless because now it's a little bit more institutional. Mm-hmm. At the time, there was a ministry called the Gospel Coalition that had just started, but it wasn't exerting any of the sort of influence that it does now. And so, yeah, it's and also, I look at some of these other things. At the time, within the Southern Baptist Convention, it was anything but clear whether or not the Calvinists would be able to stay within that denomination, or if they'd get kicked out. Hmm. Well, now a lot of the people who've been associated with this movement at varying degrees, people who are on the Gospel Coalition's council like Russell Moore, Al Mohler, and David Platt, well, they are the leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention. Yeah. And so that restlessness found an institutional home. And they actually, in many ways, became the authority. And so, yeah, in some ways, it has grown up, and in some ways, it's still restless, trying to find its way. And in some ways, it stayed restless and, you know, crashed, burned. Right. So it's really all over the map.
Now, let me ask you this: as we talk about the maturation of the young, restless, and reformed movement, one of the things that also gained its height over the last decade is social media and the interaction there. How have you guys managed keeping up with the social media generation, and what are some of the things that you found to be helpful about that, but also to be a hindrance as well to true and pure gospel ministry?
Yeah, social media is a great question, Tyler. Social media is a two-edged sword. So without social media, and keep in mind, this was a pretty prominent part of my original book that came out in 2008, was dealing with the rise of blogs. Now, Facebook was not nearly the factor then as it is now. Twitter really wasn't much of a factor at all. That really changes the game. That's part of the double-edged sword thing. But the first part is simply, without this way of connecting through ministries online, like the Reformed African American Network, through podcasting and things like that, people who were feeling isolated and discouraged and wondering if they were a little bit crazy about holding to these beliefs, would not have been able to find like-minded believers to gain encouragement. So that's been a major factor. This just would not have happened. And so in the Gospel Coalition and places like that, as time has gone along, we've continued to grow in social media, to create those communities, and it's been a major factor. I just can't imagine what anything would look like without Twitter and Facebook and what we're trying to do. When you're trying to build an audience, it's amazing. There are these low barriers to entry now that you don't need huge amounts of capital to buy all this stuff and distribute all this stuff. You can just ramp up to speed almost right away. And that's the problem as well. The problem is that we are, in part because of technology and in part because of philosophy, they really merge in places like social media. It is a radically democratic medium. And as it's radically democratic, it's also very hostile, cruel, occasionally wonderfully encouraging. It's just, it's all wrapped up in one medium. And so the same way that you're able to distribute good content that you try to edify people with, or even critical content to help people to think more biblically and with theological soundness to these trends in the culture, it's the same way that other people who really hate what you're trying to do can attack you. And so you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Right. And, you know, I don't know that there's any way to really avoid that. And I'm not sure we're ever going to be able to put that, you know, put Pandora back in the box. Pandora's box has been opened there. And it's just something that you have to deal with. If you can't handle that criticism that I was referring to earlier, it's going to be very difficult to be a writer, and it's going to be very difficult to deal with any sort of current events. Unless, of course, you've just created a worldview where you're always right and everybody else is always wrong, which actually seems to be a pretty popular posture.
Yes, we've found that. And you know, you've actually done something about it. You've written a book called Blind Spots and How to Become a Courageous, Compassionate, I'm just trying to remember, commissioned, and commissioned church, which is interesting, right? You didn't say Christian, you said church. Why was that?
Very interesting. So I believe that building off especially Paul's letter to the Corinthians, his first letter to the Corinthians, that we've all been gifted to be part of a body, that you actually value the least important in the world's eyes members of that body more than the others. And I believe that as God brings us together in his church, he gifts us differently precisely so that we can compensate for where our brothers and sisters are weak, or where they're simply not knowledgeable, or where they're struggling. And so what I wrote the book to be on like three different levels. So one level is you could look at it as a Christian and say, maybe God has especially gifted me to be courageous, but that doesn't give me a pass to never be compassionate or to never be evangelistic to fulfill the Great Commission. Because after all, Jesus gives those to all Christians, and as insofar as the Spirit of Jesus dwells within us, then we have the power to be able to do these things. But at the same time, maybe in a church, I'm really going to run the mercy ministry because I love being able to help the people who are down and out. Well, maybe I'm not going to be the kind of person then who is going to stand up and to teach on difficult issues in our culture. But I shouldn't look down on that person. I should recognize that in the body of Christ, he's gifted other people differently because all of these different aspects relate to Jesus. Well, then on the other hand, if you're somebody who loves to be able to just hang around with unbelievers and share the love of God with them and to tell mm-hmm. them about Jesus, well, that doesn't mean then that somebody over there who's really strong theologically, who loves to study and build up the church, is somehow then lesser than you because they don't have the same evangelistic gift that you have. So my thought is, in our worst, we're just going to sit in our little corners and just scream at each other over social media, or fight over each other in congregational meetings, or we're going to develop these different camps online, and we're just going to lob grenades at each other from our safe enclaves while the people in our little corner cheer us and encourage us. Mm. I mean, either we're going to do that, or we're going to follow the way of Jesus, and all of us are going to be exposed to some blind spots that we didn't know that they were there. We didn't realize that, oh, wait, I was projecting all of my fears and my strengths onto other people who don't share them. They have different strengths and they have different weaknesses. Only together in the church, empowered by the Spirit, the same Spirit, one faith, one church, one baptism, only in that body are we going to be able to together reflect the fullness of Jesus Christ and his intent for the church, of which he is the head. So it was really born a lot out of my experiences watching debates on social media, seeing mm-hmm. things in churches, and hoping that we can be mutually encouraging to one another rather than feeling self-affirmed in our criticism of other people for just being, you know, basically, thank God I'm not like those other people out there.
Right. Now, we had the privilege of taking your, scientific poll quiz with determining what our strengths are. And so mine was commissioned, and then the other two were tied. And Jamar, what was yours?
Mine, it was a tie between compassionate and courageous. So
we're in perfect balance here. That's basically what we're trying to say. I forget what Bo's was Jamar. Maybe he can chime in and tell you, flag you down and tell you what it was. But I think we're in perfect balance here. But
he's compassionate.
I actually wanted to talk about this whole idea of the balance between all these things, between courage, compassion, commission. Are these things, is it kind of a false idea to imagine that we can be perfectly balanced? Like, what are the pros and cons of having a strong lean to one or the other, and maybe a perceived weakness or lack of one or two of the other categories? Is that healthy, or should we pushing toward this balance between all three of them?
And maybe even just a quick like rundown of what it means in your taxonomy to be courageous, compassionate, or commissioned.
Yeah, well, I'll just run through it quickly. So courageous is basically be willing to stand up for Jesus and not to feel like you have to, not to be swayed by the culture, not to be swayed by criticism. Compassion is a desire to be able to minister to the poor, to the widow, to the homeless, things like that, to be able to the hands and feet of Jesus Christ out there to minister with the hands of healing. Commission is to go and to become all things to all men, that you might save some, in the like an apostle sent out to try to spread that message. So I set them out. They're all strengths, but there's a corresponding weakness. So if you could just run through them quickly, the courageous, they tend to be jerks sometimes. They tend to just not.
There you go, Jamar.
They're all, well, I mean, it's the inclination in our heart, our sinful hearts, for all of us. The compassionate, they tend to downplay doctrine in ways that are really damaging, and think the world would love us if we would just not be so mean by holding these mean beliefs. So they tend to want to say that the problem with the world's view of Christians is Christians, namely those courageous people over there. And the commission folks, they tend to want to say, well, I'm just not interested in getting into all of those specifics. That just gets in the way of people. So they tend to be, again, kind of like the compassionate people, they tend to be swayed by culture. But it's not necessarily because they're trying to be compassionate. It might be because they're just trying to be popular. And so you think then sometimes of the big mega churches that have watered down, not saying that all mega churches have done that, but some specifically that have watered down the message of Jesus Christ. So that's those are the basic three different groups. But the way it works in terms of balance is, I actually, Tyler, try to avoid that term, because it makes it feel like I could be a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this. And I'm thinking, is that what Jesus was like? Like, would you think of him as being a little courageous when the time called for it, and a little compassionate when the time called for it, and a little bit commissioned when he needed to be? No, he was all of these things at all time. And no, I mean, I don't think any one of us, because we're not Jesus and because we're sinners, this side of glory, none of us is going to be perfect in that regard. But if we take seriously what 1 Corinthians 12 and other passages say, then we ought to be able to reflect the fullness of Christ in ways that are going to be very encouraging to other believers and are going to even appeal to the world. And so I don't think this is impossible. I actually think that if you look out there in the landscape of Christian leadership, some leaders you'll be able to look at and say, you know what? Now I think I know why John Perkins is so popular, because I actually think he embodies all of these things. Hmm. And you look over there and you say, oh, well, Tim Keller is, you know, he plants a bunch of churches. He's a confessional Presbyterian who stands for biblical truth in difficult place. And he also writes a lot about deacons and started a big ministry, Mercy, in New York City. Maybe that's why he's so influential and why so many people who are very different are drawn to him as a leader. And simultaneously, it's also a way to look out there and say, oh, I see these other leaders who always are hitting the same note. And I wonder, what do they do with the rest of Scripture? Mm. Like, why are they always quoting Romans? Why are they never quoting James? Or vice versa, why do they only quote from the Sermon on the Mount, but they never go to Revelation? Well, this is part of what I'm trying to do in the book as well, to give you a way of saying, oh, maybe it's because they're really only appealing to a certain aspect of Jesus, and they're trying to convince other people that that's okay. But the only way you convince yourself that that's okay is if you're comparing yourself to other people who have similar or even different problems, instead of comparing yourself to Jesus. Mm. Because it just won't fly when you compare yourself to Jesus. It's a beautiful thing about following him. He's going to convict you of your sin, but then meet you in that place with his grace.
And I think that's what's so important about saying this is part of the church and not just being a Christian who is one or, like you said, all of these, which really doesn't work. It's really only in the community of believers that we can exhibit all of these kinds of strengths and conversely offset the weaknesses and the blind spots, hence the title, I suppose, that we would all have given our particular proclivities in this tripartite framework that you've come up with. So I thought that was a brilliant move. It simultaneously reinforces the importance of the body in general, but also specifically it affirms, like, if you are courageous or compassionate or commissioned, that's good. But then you need other people to help come alongside you and say, here's some ways you might want to be careful, because your strengths can also be your greatest weaknesses. So I appreciated that about the book. And I think it comes at a very timely point in our nation, right? So we're in the presidential election cycle right now. As we speak, it looks like Donald Trump will be the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party and Hillary Clinton for the Democrats. And Christians, particularly evangelical Christians, so defined, are stuck between a rock and a hard place. A lot of people are saying it's not really even a choice between lesser evils, but they are both two very great evils, in the sense of a Christian would not feel very... their conscience would be bound by voting for either one of them. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just wondering if blind spots as a framework applies to this, or just even your general thoughts on Christians engaging in the presidential political cycle right now.
Yeah, I guess, Jamar, I haven't sold nearly as many copies as I wanted to, because maybe the election wouldn't have turned out this way.
Yeah, right.
Not that any one book can do anything like that, but you're exactly right to be able to draw the connection. I mean, I guess I wrote this before imagining that anything like this could happen. I suppose I expected that Hillary Clinton would be the Democratic nominee, but I would not have, in my wildest dreams, be able to imagine that Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee. And that lasted for a long time, even when I thought that, I mean, even when polls showed him consistently ahead, and even when I started hearing from a lot of people about how much they loved Donald Trump, and just caught back like, wait, what? I mean, how is that even possible? But I think we're all so habituated, Jamar, to seeing other people's problems, to see the log in other people's, I mean, the speck in other people's eyes and not the log in ours. And so we've seen this in, I mean, when was the, I don't know that we can remember another presidential election where, I mean, it just seems like we've come to the point where we expect that we're not voting for a candidate, we're voting against the other candidate. And so it seems to be, we seem to be content to say, I know my guy is a jerk, but their guy's a bigger jerk. And we just seem to be okay with that. And we have entire cable networks that are designed to do that. We have entire social media accounts that are dedicated to this, websites that do this. We have entire talk radio that does this. And I don't think, I mean, I guess my thesis really hit home as a Republican or as a former Republican watching this nomination with Donald Trump play out, where I realized, oh my, like, this is so ingrained in our political system, even among many Christians, that it's enough to, I mean, it's enough to just say the other person is terrible, that you can overlook everything that's horrible about your own candidate, and that there's no way of anybody to be able to even argue reasonably with you. And in fact, you watch all these debates and nobody seems to be offering arguments at all to begin with. And you realize, my goodness, like, we're all, I mean, where is Jesus? Like, for the Christians at least, where is Jesus to be able to say, like, I'm going to stand with that guy over here. I'm not going to stand, even if I voted with this party, you know, year after year after year, and even if I think I had some good reasons, like, I'm going to stand with Jesus, because I'll tell you this, I don't expect my candidate to be perfectly godly. I'm not electing a pastor in chief, but I would expect some at least minimal standards of decency and truth and honesty. There's something that has seriously gone wrong in our discipleship if we believe that it's okay to simply hate other people as a way of confirming us in our own righteousness. And I guess I shouldn't have been, Jamar, as surprised as I was, or that I am, about that, because I wrote the book because of a deficit, not that I saw in our politics, though it certainly applies, but in our churches. Mm-hmm. So I guess I shouldn't have been surprised that the very churches that I wrote this book to are the very churches that have helped to deliver us this choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Well, I think you're being good company with folks who are surprised and would never have predicted the current climate that we're in right now. It's been interesting for me as an African American looking at particularly what's happening with the GOP, because ethnic minorities and particularly black people have, I don't think, ever really had a significant place with the Republican Party, at least not since the latter half of the 20th century on up till now. And so I feel like in this
60, not since 60.
Right. Really. Right.
Right. Right.
And so I felt like an outsider looking in. I'm just like, okay, well, what are y'all going to say and do about this? And hoping that this would be a real big moment of introspection, which it is, but it seems to me like, and I'm just, you know, I'm just talking from Jamar's perspective here. It seems to me like even with so back in 2012, when they lost, when the Republicans lost the White House again, there was this big report, you know, basically autopsy of the Republican Party. And one of the main outcomes of that report was we need to be broader and incorporate the concerns of ethnic minorities into our platform more intentionally and more compassionately. And that report really, in my view, didn't change much about how the party operated. And then here comes Trump, who is verbally antagonizing almost the latent racism in America and saying blatantly racist things. And even that, it's still a long, slow, uphill climb, particularly for, I guess you would say, establishment Republicans to say, hey, wait a minute, now we really need to take into consideration the concerns of ethnic minorities and make sure that the Democrats aren't the only ones who are talking about these kinds of things. I mean, from your perspective, especially as a Christian who was in the Republican Party, in terms of its sort of insight into ethnic minority concerns, where is the party now? How has this election impacted that?
Yeah, let me give you some context there. So 2002, first election I voted in was 2000, voted for George W. Bush, and you know, seemed like a seemed like a good thing. I mean, of course, this is one of the most outspoken born again candidates that we've seen in presidential history. In 2001, the attacks of September 11th happened in my junior year, or actually before my junior year of college. I went after that summer and I worked on Capitol Hill. I was working with the chair of the House Republican Conference, J.C. Watts. So one of the leaders of the Republican House. And I was he was a member of the Homeland Security Committee at the time. That's part of the reason I went out there to work. I also raised money with the Republican National Committee, and which was across the street from where I worked. And my best friend there was an Indian American whose dad had immigrated from India. So I was working at the time for the only black Republican in Congress, and then also working with other Republicans who were ethnic minorities in this case. Our office, now that I reflect back on it, they might have been the first black SGA president at Ole Miss. I worked with another Asian American. So my exposure to the Republican Party was that these were the folks who were standing up for a lot of the concerns I had as an evangelical, including abortion, marriage, things like that. But that also it was a place that was seeking, that didn't have a good track record since the 1960s, but maybe that was an aberration, and that the legacy we were dealing with was truly the Lincoln legacy and the legacy of people who all the way through Jackie Robinson were outspoken Republicans, at least for a time. And so that was my background. That's obviously I was myself a minority as I look back now. And I don't think I could have seen without Donald Trump's candidacy how core white resentment is to Republican identity, whether in an explicit way, which Trump seems more than content to be explicit about, but even in implicit ways. And now that I reflect back on history, you realize that, well, there's always been a party that reflects whites in America. Whether related to immigration, related to minority rights, there's always been a party that seems to be the one that stands up for white people and whatever their perceived grievances might be, or whatever their perceived what are their assumed privileges of being the people who are truly America. I can't imagine anything better than Donald Trump's candidacy to be able to expose that that core to Republican Party appeal, because you and I have talked about this before, Jamar, but two things are striking to me. One, that to make the economic appeal to Donald Trump, you have to maybe he's just speaking to the issues of poorer whites, lower middle class whites, in a way that other Republicans, especially Mitt Romney, were not able to. Well, in one sense, I'd actually be pretty sympathetic with economic arguments that would not toe the line of big business that Mitt Romney did. I thought that was a major mistake in Mitt Romney's campaign. In part, I come from lower middle class, Midwest on a farm. So I'm not one of those people who grew up rich in a suburb or a city or something like that. So I'm open to that. But if that's the case, then why is he getting no support from other poorer people, especially ethnic minorities? And why is the average Trump supporter household income about $70,000? It just doesn't seem to add up there. And here's the other issue that you and I have talked about, Jamar. Republicans seem to have had no problem with Donald Trump throwing all of their other party orthodoxy out the window. So on healthcare, on abortion, whatever else he might want to say about being pro-life, on marriage, on transgender issues, on taxes, on trade, on war and the military, on tell me, what area has he not thrown out the window from GOP orthodoxy? Mm-hmm. Well, he's basically ignored everything except for those things that seem to relate to ethnic minorities, especially things like immigration. you know, we could have a good debate about immigration and talk about different aspects of policy, but that's not what Donald Trump is inviting us to. He's encouraging an outright us versus them racism, which essentially says that people who look that way are trying to take what belongs to you. I mean, that's not an immigration policy.
Right.
That's merely appealing to racism. And so I don't know how to interpret Trump's candidacy except to say that it's reflective of, well, that it's an eye-opening experience for me that indicates that I can no longer be associated with this Republican Party. And I'll give you an example. So I have a friend of mine, one of my wife's best friends from college. She's Jewish and an activist on immigration, especially for Latin American, South American immigration policies. She's significantly more liberal than I am on every issue, including on the immigration issue. And when Trump's candidacy came around, she reached out to me and to my wife and asked what we thought about this. And I knew something very clear in what she was saying. She was asking us, I have never agreed with you guys about politics or your faith and what you say about Jesus Christ, but I've always respected you. And I've always believed that I can trust you and that you are good people. So it was a pretty clear issue there for me of saying whatever else I might have wanted to say about my faith in Jesus Christ, there was simply no way that I could retain any credibility whatsoever in the eyes of this friend if I thought that being a disciple of Jesus Christ was consistent for advocating for Donald Trump's candidacy. And for me, guys, this is an issue of my evangelistic integrity, not because of some kind of liberal conservative thing, not because of Supreme Court appointees or whatever else the people who listen to this I'm sure are going to bring up and hold against me. But actually, it's about Colin, I see you talking about this man, Jesus Christ, over here. And I see who this man over here is in Donald Trump, and they don't seem to have anything in common with one another. I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, but I'm just asking you, does that work as a Christian? I'm telling you guys, maybe other people will come to a different conclusion. It doesn't work for me. Doesn't work.
Is it
doesn't work.
Is it a question of degrees, though? I mean, what is the difference? So maybe Donald Trump is the volume turned up to 10 and they broke the knob off.
Right.
But are other candidates, the volume's turned up to 5? And
well, that's why I don't believe I can support a Republican Party that makes its peace with Donald Trump. Because to make its peace with Donald Trump is to tell me that whatever else they said and believed was a lie, that they identify with his core message, which is what we've just described right there. So I might have argued with you before, Jamar, about that, and I might have argued for the integrity of a lot of men and women I really respected in the Republican Party. But to see them say nothing, nothing in critique of Donald Trump, and to then announce that they will publicly support him is not an offense that I can forgive, at least in terms of those party allegiances. And I believe then, for the sake of my testimony as a Christian, really for the sake of my own integrity, it's just not something I can associate with. So I need to pick a time here to officially disaffiliate with the Republican Party. I always knew this moment might come, and I actually had told all of my friends that I thought the Republican Party would disappear as we knew it after this election. I just didn't think it would be quite this way. My thought was that the social conservatives are not enough in today's America to be able to win for the Republican Party, so that they would have to get rid of the social conservatives to be able to try to build a different coalition. And what I expected is that the Republicans would actually try to outflank the Democrats to the left on any number of issues, including social issues, and try to build a more consistently libertarian and selfish, I think, in a lot of ways, approach, which is the opposite of what I would hope that they would have done there. And so I expected to be a man without a home and without a party. But it didn't happen quite the way that I thought it would. And the surprise to me has been that Republicans have been so willing, elected Republican officials have been so willing to go along with it with so little resistance. That's the one thing. And second, that it turns out the Republicans won't have to get rid of social conservatives. Because apparently the social conservatives will tolerate anything. And they'll just vote because the person has an R next to his name. And so apparently now the Republicans will be able to try a different strategy where they can just ignore any social conservative issues and then try to reach out to different kinds of people through, I guess, the theatrics and the vulgarity. I don't think there'll be another candidate like Trump to come around next time, but I certainly don't expect other candidates to imagine that things like honesty or integrity or honor or courage or fidelity are important. Because if social conservatives don't think they're important, then why should anybody else think they're important? Sorry, guys, I could keep ranting on that. Straight no chaser. Go in, jump in.
Yeah, no, I think that's very helpful to hear. Now, you're talking about what you're disassociating from, but what are you now going to associate with and to? How do we reflect Christ as you say, hey, I'm going to stand with Jesus? How do we reflect Christ in an environment like this, where it feels as though for many social conservatives or many people who are voting in general, there's no home, there's no affiliation on earth. So how do we cope and how do we manage? And what are some things you're doing to deal with that whiplash?
Yeah, I mean, it's an open question. I'm open to counsel and to leadership on these things. It's been a hard time. Just as somebody who's voted Republican, as somebody who thought of things a certain way, like I don't agree with the Republican Party on everything, but I think abortion is such an important issue that I've been very defensive because I've thought, well, but we have to have at least one party because Democrats have abandoned social conservatives. They didn't used to be that way either, but they've entirely abandoned social conservatives. And I think there was a real watershed moment in 2012 when the Democratic National Convention was unashamedly pro-abortion. I do not say that lightly. I'm not saying pro-choice. I'm saying pro-abortion. It was another eye-opening thing for me. And so if the Republicans are not going to offer a viable alternative to that, which they obviously won't, then I don't have a place to go because I'm not going to shift over to the Democratic Party for that reason. I'd be open to any number of views that the Democrats might hold on foreign policy or economic policy or immigration or things like that. I might be open if they cared what I thought, but they don't. But I guess that's the thing either. No, Republicans obviously don't care what I think either. I'm not saying that they should. I mean, of course, I'd want that. I'm just trying to reflect the political reality. I spoke up and there aren't many of me. So I don't have a home anymore. I mean, if the Republicans can do this and they don't need me, then they'll just move on. And I need to figure out what to do from there. There's a new book called Fractured Republic that I'm reading about right now from somebody who worked in the Bush administration. Really what it's talking about is the problem with our national political discourse and the vitriol going back and forth and the obsession, like the stakes are just too high. The stakes are too high for our national politics. And so what can we do to de-escalate things and turn our attention toward the families, communities, churches, social institutions that are closer to us to try to do some good? And Tyler, that's basically what I'm trying to do now, is to turn my attention toward those relationships and those institutions that I have some leadership and responsibility for, namely, you know, my own soul, for my family, my household, my church, my community, my city, things like that. So I'm trying to, I don't really know what, I mean, I look at the abortion issue and I say, like, this is going to end badly. I don't believe in my lifetime there will ever be either party that will advocate for the lives of the unborn from here on out, at least on a national level. I don't think once the Republicans have nominated a pro-choice, well, basically, I mean, assumed to be a pro-choice candidate because his pro-life argumentation is completely unbelievable in Donald Trump, that they will ever go back from that once that fear factor is gone from offending social conservatives. So I don't really know what to do. I'm just assuming all these things related to religious liberty and marriage and abortion at the Supreme Court level and at the national level will simply be lost. I don't really know that there's anything I can do about that. And so I'm just trying to turn my attention toward those things that are closer to me and to try to build up those institutions to be able to love others. And it's also another thing that I'll say, I think maybe especially relevant to this podcast. I live as probably some people know in the Deep South in Birmingham, Alabama. And I've lived here for 4 years. I've spent a lot of time over the last number of years of truly trying to understand what this city is all about and understand its history, the good and also especially the bad. And so one of the things that I see this as an opportunity to be able, now that I'm personally broken out of this two-party structure, is to revisit certain issues and to revisit certain relationships. Now that we're not encumbered by this national political red versus blue dynamic, to say, what are some new solutions that we might be able to seek? What are some conversations we're able to have? I was talking with an African American brother not long ago, and I was mentioning my serious concern about abortion. And he started talking to me about healthcare as a life issue and things like that. And I could tell that maybe in some ways he was reflexive of arguing with white evangelicals a lot about abortion and being frustrated with their perspective. And I tried to stop him and say, hey, I'm actually not arguing with you about healthcare. I'm not trying to tell you that you're wrong about healthcare. I'm wanting to have that conversation with you. So don't hear me saying that this abortion issue over here means that I don't have to care about this issue that's really close to home for you. No, I want to talk with you about that, and I want to be creative, and I want to see how we can work together as brothers in Christ to be able to address these concerns. And so I'm looking forward to those opportunities to say, well, gosh, I mean, what have I missed? What are some of the blind spots that have developed and gotten larger because of my own political views that I now feel free to explore? You know, the light has shone on some of them. And now, like, what am I seeing for the first time? Who am I seeing for the first time? What am I seeing now from a different vantage point? Like you said earlier, Jamar, the typical African-American critique of the Republican Party and of white America is a lot more persuasive to me now than it was before. Not because I didn't think it had any merit, but because I just could not have envisioned it was as bad as people said that it was. And now, mind you, I've done, you know, my share of reading on civil rights and things like that. So this, I think God had been preparing me for this moment in my study of the 60s and 70s and in my living in Birmingham, Alabama in particular. I mean, I gotta say, guys. I mean, just to shed light on how I'm dealing with this. We have a situation now in the state of Alabama where the white evangelical governor has had an affair and is facing calls. He's been disciplined and kicked out of his Baptist church. Mm. Okay, first of all, and now he's being facing all these calls to resign. The Speaker of the House, a white evangelical Republican, is currently on trial for corruption of having taken money from casinos to be able to try to stop gambling from coming into Alabama. We don't have a state lottery. So essentially, you'll appreciate this, Jamar, basically, it's casinos in Mississippi and in Alabama that are trying to keep the business from getting out. So he's being alleged to have used a Christian explanation for why he's taken this dirty money. Mm. We also have a white evangelical Republican chairman of the state Supreme Court Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, who's also getting kicked out because he's not conforming in this case to, he's trying to carve out space for judges to not have to perform civil ceremonies for same-sex couples. Well, I may agree with him in certain ways, but the point is, like, he's just not going to be able to get away with this. Okay, that's the Republican Party in the state where I live. It's not all bad, but hello, I mean, these are the most visible Republicans in this state. Now let's look at this other situation. Okay, so I live in a wonderful community. There are a lot of wonderful people here. A lot of wonderful churches. It's a very wealthy, prosperous community. Average household income is about $150,000. I mean, we're talking about one of the wealthiest communities in the entire country. Within like 20 minutes of us, you have literally a failed state situation in Fairfield, Alabama. They are having to shut off the water because the city can't pay for the water anymore. Bus service has stopped. Basically, what happened was there was one Walmart, which was more or less the entire sales tax base for this city. It left for various reasons. The city has no money. We're talking no fire department, no police force, no nothing. A failed state, United States of America. People are talking about Michigan, talking about Flint. Okay, bad situation there as well. I'm staring at this situation. I've got good close friends who've lived in Fairfield or who have friends in Fairfield. I have a good friend who's a minister in Fairfield. Like, that's my city. That's my community. Those are my neighbors. Our national political situation isn't going to do anything about that. Yeah. Our national politicians don't care. Hillary Clinton doesn't care about the people there. And heck, she did a campaign stop in that area. She's not caring about this. My local government isn't going to be able to care about this. The local government has failed those people. Democrats have failed those people. The state government has failed those people. I mean, and this is a community also that was almost universally white through the 60s, that went through terrible racial turmoil, and that whites are certainly at some degree responsible and complicit in what has happened. That they can't just wipe their hands and say, yeah, when all of us left because of desegregation, that we can just blame all the black people for what's happening. That's within the lifetimes of a lot of people who live in this city. So that's a long answer to your question, Tyler, but like, that gives me more than enough opportunity to try to exercise my faith and to try to seek, represent Jesus, and to try to seek some kind of political redress for this situation. And what would it say about me if I were spending my time caring about what was happening between fools like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and ignore my brother and sister who is right on the other side of this city?
That's good.
I mean, that's so you're asking, what am I doing? That's what I'm doing. And hopefully I can only hope that in this sort of repentance process that I can reappropriate my personal assets to try to address energy and money and what and time to try to help my brother and sister in need in my own city.
Jamar, we got to bring Colin back on just to talk about the South.
Man.
Just to talk about the South. Like, that's it.
Well, we got to do in the South, a video series, a blog series that. Between us. Yes, yes, yes. Colin, this has been extremely enlightening, brother. We knew we had you on here for a reason. You've been really helpful, and it's timely. So thank you so much for your time. I'm looking forward to the TGC Women's Conference, which is coming up in a couple of weeks in June. We'll have a couple of our folks from RAND there. And then, of course, the national conference next year, where we'll I get to do my first workshop at TGC. So thank you again for the opportunity. And brother, let's do this again soon.
I love what you guys are doing. I'm happy to help in any way I can and come on another time. But keep up the good work, guys. God bless.
All right.
Thank you, Colin. We want to thank Colin Hanson for joining us on this episode of Pass the Mic. You can learn more about him at thegospelcoalition.org and pick up his book, Blind Spots.
As always, you can learn more about the Reformed African American Network by visiting randnetwork.org. You can also follow the network on Twitter at @RandNetwork, as well as the show at _PassTheMic. Don't forget to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Reformed African Americans. Pass the Mic is a collaborative effort between the Reformed African American Network and Podastery Studios. Visit Podastery.com to discover the highest in quality online audio entertainment. Our producer for this show, as always, is Bo York, and our co-host has been Jamar Tisby, and I've been your host, Tyler Burns, and we'll see you soon on the next
Pass the Mic.
You've been listening to Pass the Mic, a Podastery production. To find out more about this and other shows, visit podastery.com. That's podastery.com.
This episode was brought to you in part by United We Pray. United We Pray is a podcast devoted to praying and thinking about racial strife, especially between Christians. Come join us in praying for the unity of God's people.